All right, I think we're live. Just getting to my seat. So, good afternoon. Welcome to Talking Tech. It's still morning. Okay, so from the background, I heard it's still morning. So, good morning. Welcome to Talking Tech. This is our technology news and call-in show for the Madison Public Library. Feel free to throw anything in the chat, and we'll try to answer it to the best of our ability. And while we're waiting for people to join us with chat, we'll talk about various news stories that we find interesting. So with me is...
I'm Charlie. I'm the Gutting, Ohio Online Learning Coach here at the Public Library.
And my name is Sean Walsh, and I'm the Merchant Services and Technologies Librarian. And with us in the studio also is Melanie Lytle, Head of Public Services. And so she's also going to be chiming in, though she doesn't have a nearby mic. So as we're waiting for people to chime in on... Because we're available on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it this week. And several other platforms, we can see your questions. And if you don't get a question in while we're live, feel free to throw something in after the fact. We'll see it there and answer you back. So you want to go ahead and get started, Charlie?
Well, I mean, I guess we could start off with some weird forms of cryptocurrency here.
Okay.
But it's not that there's a new form, which there are too many forms to count anymore.
Yeah.
GameStop is pulling out of the NFT game.
That's not surprising.
Yeah.
I think everybody is.
Everyone expected this at this point. But yeah, GameStop is going to stop the NFT marketplace on February 2nd due to the continuing regularity uncertainty of crypto space.
That's a polite way of saying this just isn't working.
Yep.
So to kind of explain what NFT is again, so it's non-fungible tokens, which is basically it's like having a signed baseball card. Is the best way to describe it. Generally, NFTs, when you see them, are images that are created by a specific illustrator, artist, whatever. And so that has value. So it'd be like saying, this is a digital Monet or Van Gogh or whatever. Okay, so there's one of them in existence. We know that it goes back to this author. We've kind of authenticated it. That's how kind of how NFTs work. There are other NFTs. Another example of an NFT would be like a signature. So like, say I went to a convention and got a picture signed by, say, Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker or the Joker in the animated Batman series. You know, I have Mark Hamill's autograph. I know that happened. We've authenticated it. So that autograph has value and it is a thing. So that's what NFTs are. But the interesting thing is, I think we started to run before we walked. So NFTs kind of tie into cryptocurrency and tie into a lot of stuff. And, you know, someone said, we can do this, and they did it. And people said, let's throw money at it. And then everyone went, but how are we going to figure this out? Because there's, you know, there's already existing markets for signatures and artwork and collectible things like comics and, you know, comic artwork and stuff. And so I think that they tried to do an end run around some of that stuff. Plus, in all honesty, there's some lawsuits going on with some places that, let's just say, allegedly did not practice things correctly and may have done some insider trading and all kinds of fun things. So it's still the Wild West. Like, I wouldn't necessarily dump my entire life savings into NFTs and expect to get rich. You may for a day, and then you may lose it all, just like Bitcoin or any kind of cryptocurrency.
Especially so with the current state,
yeah, the market's kind of crazy and volatile. And I mean, I guess my best way also describe kind of cryptocurrency and NFTs is it's not any different than the stock market. You know, right now Microsoft is doing incredibly well. So throw some money at Microsoft. That's what everybody will say. Tomorrow Microsoft could be doing terrible, and you've lost all your money. You know, it is what it is. My best advice I ever got was from my economics teacher in high school. He said, well, if you want to invest in the stock market, mm-hmm. you take a bunch of money. And if you're willing to take that money and light it on fire or throw it in a chipper shredder, mm-hmm. then invest it. If you can't live without that money, mm-hmm. don't invest it. And I've always kind of ran with that. So, hey, shout out to Mr. Ard, Hubbard High School. I've taken your advice. All right, so we talked about cryptocurrency and NFTs for a while. We've been talking about this for months if you follow us anywhere on any of our streaming platforms.
Months, years, however.
Months, years, decades, forever. So Wi-Fi 7, Charlie. Wi-Fi 7 got approved. So Wi-Fi 7.
Just got over Wi-Fi 6.
I know. So Wi-Fi 7, and I had to get the letters for it, so I looked it up. So Wi-Fi 7 is 802.11be. B-E?
B-E?
Yeah, because okay. 802, Wi-Fi 6 was 802.11ax. So here's the thing. When you got started with Wi-Fi, most of us probably, you know, started with something that was labeled 802.11b, and then there was A, and then there was C, and N, and, you know.
You may have a question already.
Yep, so Melanie has a question.
Okay, so the Wi-Fi things, why isn't it going in an order? Like, when Microsoft does stuff, they had, like, 3.1, and then their numbers went up chronologically.
Well, their numbers went up chronologically, and then all of a sudden they went to XP.
Right. And
Vista.
But then they started another number sequence.
Yeah.
So this is not following. I see the 802 part, but I don't understand why you do an A than something else, because that is not the alphabet.
Correct. And so if you didn't hear it well, Melanie is asking why sometimes the letters don't go in sequence. And the reason for that is actually the letters are coming out in sequence, but the manufacturers aren't releasing things on that standard sometimes when that number has already been approved. So A existed, but we didn't have any equipment for A. And B came out, and B was vastly more popular. And then some people wrote some things and created some equipment for A, and then A came out. And so A and B were fighting with each other, and then people started making devices with A and B together. And so then they said 802.11c, and then, you know, 802.11n, and then forth. The standards come out from the IEEE people. So they're electrical engineers to society. They come up with these standards. They come up with the settings. And then industry comes out, and they sometimes use these standards as like a brand name. Mm-hmm. So 802.11b was very much like Pentium, which doesn't actually mean anything. It's just what Intel used, or Ryzen, or Ryzen. How do you pronounce Ryzen?
Ryzen.
I don't say it right. It's an AMD chip. So they come out with those things. So generally, we're starting to go into the standards now. So I said Wi-Fi 7. From 5, 6, and 7, they're starting to use Wi-Fi 5, Wi-Fi 6, Wi-Fi 7 to represent these next standards, okay? It's just very, very much like 3G, 4G, and 5G. 3G, 4G, 5G have all their other numbers with them that we never use. You know, all they are is the next standard, the next iteration. So going back to Wi-Fi 7, so 7 is out. So again, 7 is going to be labeled as, I got to look at it again, BE. So BE like BC. It's kind of funny. So it's going to work on the same spectrums as we had before. So the 2.4 and the 5. So these are spectrums we've used for a while now. But what they're changing is how much they're putting across those spectrums. So we're using the same spectrum, but we're pushing more data. So every time they go up in a standard, ideally the whole point is to solve a problem or make it go faster. In this case, it did both, actually. Big thing with the new standard 7, which devices will start coming out fairly soon, now that it's been mentioned at the Consumer Electronics Show and a couple other places, 7 has more throughput, so it's double of 6. Mm-hmm. So 6 is closest to energy. I can't remember which one. I think it's N. I think 5 was G. So it's just double the speed. So your wireless connection from your phone, your tablet, your laptop, whatever, is going to be faster back to the access point. The other big thing, and this is where it kind of, I'm looking forward to it. It's looking at trying to handle interference. Because that's been our big thing for a long time. So 2.4 gigahertz was the same spectrum that portable phones. So if you had a portable land phone, which is ironic because it's wireless land phone, a portable phone, not a mobile phone, not a cell phone, but like, you know, the ones that were tied still to a line in your house, those run on that spectrum. Microwaves run on that spectrum. A couple other things run all on that spectrum. And so the running joke was that, you know, people's Wi-Fi get interrupted when you got a phone call on your house and stuff like that. And that's way back in the early 90s. But we still have some other interference. We have other devices now. We have Bluetooth devices that are talking, like our smartwatches, our health monitors, all that stuff on different spectrums. Other devices are reaching out to other spectrums and talking. And so the whole point of 7 is to create some ways to handle interruptions. Because currently, when there's an interruption, it just goes, okay, well, I'll start again. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's trying to mitigate those interruptions. So instead of just saying, I'll start again, I'm still on the same channel, but I'm going to start again. It's saying, hey, let's change channels. Let's find a way around wherever this noise is, mm-hmm. And get around it, which is going to be beneficial to everyone. Because the number one thing that interrupts your hotspots, your cell phones, your all of this is this kind of data interruption. And it happens, and it's not always the same kind of interruption. Some data interruption happens because of weather. Some data interruption happens because of humidity. That's what this standard is trying to handle. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and it's a useful deal. So it's going to be faster, and it's going to be more stable. That's our goal. In reality, heaven knows. Because these standards aren't out yet, so there's no devices to play with yet. And even if you get a Wi-Fi 7 cell phone, you're going to need to have an access point to tie it to, mm-hmm. which means you change up your access point in your house or you update the firmware. Because sometimes you can't update an existing access point to get new standards. So periodically, your Wi-Fi access point at your home, whether it's yours or provided by someone else, should be updated mm-hmm. regularly, not just for security things, but for added features. Same thing with the thing you provided by your telco, Spectrum, Kinetic, whoever. Periodically, those devices should be updated. Now, those companies should update their own stuff, but the easiest way to trigger it is sometimes to turn it off for about a half hour and then turn it back on again. That'll trigger an update. When it connects back home, it calls home and says, hey, I'm alive again. Those updates. So power outages sometimes do us better than you can imagine because it restarts devices. So what else you got, Charlie?
Well, I got something about some phone technology.
Okay.
So we all know the foldable phones that we've seen for the past couple
of years. The OLED foldable folding phones? Kind so of, the screen yeah. folds? Okay. I got hand motions.
What if I were to say that we could open a phone and bend it backwards?
Oh, that would be scary in some ways, but makes sense.
Yeah. So Samsung has decided to try
they're throwing all in on this stuff.
Double hinge smartphone. So it will fold.
I'm watching your video on the screen.
Uh-huh. And it will fold back.
Yeah.
Thus making the screen visible for the backside.
Yeah. Do you remember those Jacob Ladders toys that we played with kids where the thing would click, 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 click all the way down? That's kind of what it looks like on the video. That's freaky.
Yeah, but essentially the hinge is supposed to be updated from the original.
Uh-huh.
As for the folding backward
part.
But essentially, it will disable the screen on one end and it will keep the screen on the other end.
Interesting.
If you are viewing it from only the one side.
Interesting.
So it's kind of interesting. But they're kind of taking away the little screen that was on the other Samsung flips that they just released a couple.
Yeah, the screen ago. Everybody likes, whether they're using it for taking selfies and mm-hmm. things. Yeah, interesting. Technology is getting more interesting. And so OLEDs is organic light emitting diodes. Just think about it as it's a screen for your phone that happens to be flexible by nature. And so that's where these folding phones are really starting to happen. And that's whenever like Charlie and I talk about, I was going to reach for my arm, talk about having like a screen on your arm that's like attached, like a bracelet or a Vembrace. That's what these are. Is these OLEDs. They're making screens. That's why you can get curved screens now. And Charlie's more of a gamer that would appreciate that than I do. But, you know, some people go on about, you know, the curved screen makes it so much more immersive. Yeah. Okay, he has a Mac too. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting folding. So, I was going to talk a little bit about Glowforge. So, wow. Glowforge, they laid off a bunch of people.
Oh boy.
They weren't that big to begin with. So they laid off like 30 people, and that was a chunk of their workforce. Yeah. We use Glowforge products here. A lot of people use Glowforge products. They're a laser engraving company. So they're changing up their market. And that's part of the reason why they laid off some people is they're trying to streamline. They're going after the same market as the people who get Cricuts. So Cricut is a CNC paper and vinyl cutter. And if you know anybody who does card making, scrapbooking, shirts, people use Cricuts. That's them. That's, you know, it's a huge marketplace. Any craft store, there's Cricut branding stuff everywhere. There's Cricut aisles, I noticed, in stores. The folks from Glowforge who've made lasers, and they have made what I consider a hobby laser, but their hobby laser is still a couple thousand dollars. It was not inexpensive. They are now targeting, it's a almost a sub $1,000 laser now. $1,199 laser. Out of the box, preloaded with stuff, very much reminds me of the Cricut. So it would be complimentary. So if you are a Cricut person and you make t-shirts and all that stuff, this Glowforge is targeting you to now start doing stuff with acrylic and wood, almost the same projects, because they kind of do overlap. Some people will make signs, who make shirts and that kind of stuff. We see a lot of that at the library here. So I find it interesting that they're kind of retooling and restructuring, and they're targeting specifically the same market as the Cricut, not overlapping, but being complementary. So it's like going to a store, you know, and there's a laundry there and there's a grocery. The two things target the same audience. The same people going out to the store are probably going to do laundry too, you know, and or dry cleaning. But they don't kill each other off because they're totally separate. So it's the same concept. So I find that interesting. So we're going to be watching Glowforge. I mean, we have one here at the library that we use along with our other lasers. And there's pros and cons to everything. So if you're ever interested, stop in, talk to us about it. So yeah, so Glowforge is starting to target the Cricut people.
All right.
Okay, I've got another question.
All right, Melanie has a question.
I think I may be the sole question provider for today.
That's okay.
All right. So if Glowforge is going after the Cricut people, then the Cricut works off their cloud-based design.
The Cricut design space, yeah.
So Glowforge has their own
cloud. Glowforge is always, so Melanie's asking about the cloud-based end of the Cricut. Yeah, Glowforge has always been cloud-based. There's never been an interface directly to talk to the Glowforge, which we find kind of annoying here, actually, because it's totally web-based, and there are times you want to directly talk to the device.
So is the assumption then, because the Cricut people are already used to working in a cloud-based environment,
that it's an easy transition?
Where you have like six fonts that are free and 7,200 that you correct. Have to pay for, that essentially that's where Glowforge is getting their money because you're paying
for Glowforge has actually always been that way. Glowforge has a similar setup where if you want to use fonts, you pay for them. If you want to use certain settings, that you pay for them. And it's the same as buying your material from the Cricut branded material and the Cricut fonts. All of that was purchased through your design space. Glowforge has been the same. We're fortunate here that we have a designer in-house that can create some of the stuff we need for the Glowforge. Otherwise, we'd be paying the monthly Glowforge fee to have access to the fonts. And you have to pay for things separately. Like their specialty wood, you know, I can spend, what, a dollar something for a piece of wood, and their specialty wood is like 16 for the Glowforge. But it has a little QR code on it. You put in the Glowforge, it scans it, sets all the settings. Everything is set for you. You don't have to know anything, and it'll cut. So it's made to basically, you know, plug and play. Throw that piece in there, but you got to buy their settings.
So you're plug and play, but you're more expensive because it's plug and play.
Hands down. And that's why the Cricut is more expensive in some ways. Because it's plug and play, but there are people who work the Cricut and know how to use the design space and create all the stuff outside the design space and bring it in, just like we do. So, yeah.
Okay. I think that answers.
Good question. So, again, if you want to ask questions, feel free to ask questions at any time. We appreciate that, and throw them in the chat or drop them in a message after the fact. So, thank you. All right. So, is it bouncing? No, I just did Glowforge, so it's bounced back to you.
Yeah. So, how about e-ink?
Okay, e-ink. So what most of the e-readers are made in. Yeah.
What if I were to say that we're finding more ways to use e-ink as just secondary screens?
Secondary screens? Okay. Because e-ink is limited in what it can display.
So how about the back of a phone?
Okay.
You change the style of your phone. Instead of changing the case on the back of your phone, you change the e-ink on the screen.
So it's a back. It's a display on the back that then could be modified to show images, shapes,
like
whatever.
Showing here.
Yeah, I can see it on your screen. Yeah. So yeah, it'd be like having a different case on the back of your phone on a regular basis. I find that interesting.
Instead of being limited to, but this is not the only only thing e-ink is being
currently
looked at for. But CES really pushed e-ink for just about everything this year.
And a little aside, a lot of the e-ink development is done at Kent Displays, which is not connected to Kent State University, but feeds from Kent State University because they have a liquid crystal engineering program at Kent. And so a lot of cool e-ink stuff happens in Ohio. and then is then shipped out. Like there's a company called Boogie Board, which has a huge chunk of the e-ink market and was all developed literally at Kent Displays and by Kent State University graduates. So yeah, major e-ink hub in Kent, Stowe, Kent, Stowe, a little bit of Ravana. So that whole area right there in Portage County. Yeah. Hmm. Yep.
Interesting. Yeah, but no, e-ink slowly but surely making a little bit of a comeback. Yeah, in
beyond e-readers.
Yeah, beyond e-readers and just black and white.
Yeah, color. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Getting some color in there.
That's cool. That's very cool. All right. So since this is our first show of the 2024 and everyone's on resolutions and whatnot, I found an interesting one. So engineers from a couple of different universities are developing a capsule that you take prior to eating that will vibrate and trick your stomach into thinking it is full. Because what it is doing is it's agitating the inside of your stomach in a way that your stomach views it as full, that you've eaten a lot of stuff. So instead of a gastric bypass or gastric band or something like that, you take this pill and it literally vibrates. You know, I mean, we're not talking like cell phone vibrate, you know, some kind of minuscule vibration enough to trick your stomach into thinking that you have eaten a full meal. Now, I was trying to reading through and they're doing clinical trials with animals and they're doing some stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So nothing like you're not going to see it advertised on your afternoon shows or anything. you know, take this miracle pill to make you lose weight, but it's coming. And it is a little fascinating. I was trying to do the research to figure out, like, is it timed? Does the pill know that you've eaten? Do you have to be really strict? Like, oh, okay, I take the pill, and in 10 minutes, I know I will not want to eat anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't nail it down to that. The article was pretty much an overview, but I found it fascinating. So it's nothing different than the pills that we are taking now that take that do camera shots.
Yeah.
You know, that'll instead of having a scoping either up or down, to see what's going on with your intestinal tract or your stomachs or whatever your esophagus, you know, you're taking these pills that are basically a camera that rides through and take pictures every couple of seconds. It's nothing different than that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't look like they were big. So it's not like you're swallowing, you know, something that's like a golf ball, you know, or it's pretty small. So I found that fascinating. Hmm. Okay. So what else you got?
What about Google and Samsung team up to simplify sharing?
So I find this interesting. That's Google and Samsung, who are technically going head to head in the cell phone market, you know, but now they're teaming up for sharing for other things, huh?
So similar to Apple's version of just what is it called, AirDrop?
Yeah.
They're trying to do the same thing here with through all Android devices.
Okay.
Instead of just through Pixels and their own, like Samsung's own.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's AirDropping. It's also casting to TVs.
Okay.
Because I know Samsung is a good partner with Google and their assistant most of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, Samsung tries to push their own, like Bixby.
Yeah.
What they're trying to do is they're just trying to unify them both together.
That'd be nice.
At the current point in time, and they're working on, you know, all TVs and everything else.
So okay.
It'll just make sharing things with people a little bit easier.
Okay. I'm all for interoperability. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's currently our conundrum with most of our devices is, you know, are you the Apple person? Are you the Android person? Are you the Samsung person? Are you the Pixel person? Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain advantages to those platforms. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, when you're in an environment where you need to share a bunch of stuff, whether it's a work environment or whatever, that's when, you know, that's when you end up with a corporate phone. Mm-hmm. Why do you have a corporate phone? So that everyone is on the same platform so we can share everything without having to figure out a million hoops to jump through. But I mean, frankly, you know, like, you know, just for me and you, because we're on two different phone platforms, it'd be easier for me to share something to you if it was a little more interoperable. Mm-hmm. I'm all for that.
Yeah, but no, it'll be interesting to see how it comes out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only speculation at this point. In the partnership as this current point in time.
Yeah, partnerships are a famous thing because they last for a little while and then they go away and then sometimes they don't come back.
Everyone asks where it happened or where it went and then they're like, well.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow.
You know, that kind of.
Legals.
Yeah.
Exactly. Legal stuff. Yeah. All right. So, well, you know what? I'm going to talk a little bit about Apple briefly.
Okay.
And then I'm going to talk about Microsoft. because it's Microsoft and Apple. So just recently, Microsoft edged out Apple as the world's most valuable company.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yep. So going back to that whole investment thing we were talking about earlier, but the reason I kind of watch the investment stuff is it's a good way to see how well products are being adopted by a specific company or how well people are taking to their devices or their services or whatever. Microsoft and Apple are pretty diverse companies, but this is the first time that in a long time that I can remember that anybody took out Apple. Because Apple's been at the top of the chart because, I mean, Apple devices are very pervasive, you know, and people love their Apple devices. And the interesting thing is, you know, and you can take this back to when Steve Jobs passed away, Apple has gotten less interesting mm-hmm. in the last few years.
No, I can agree.
It used to be that people would stop their day for an Apple, you know, CEO video. You know, literally, I was places where the technology folks, every single person stopped because Apple was doing a live video of something at CES or somewhere. I don't know anybody who does that anymore. They okay, Apple really something, whatever. Is it interesting? You know, and they haven't really done anything interesting in, you know, their cell phone market isn't really that interesting lately. Their desktop and laptop market. I mean, when's the last time you heard anybody say anything interesting, anybody go, oh my gosh, you know, how about that latest MacBook? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a Mac person, you're excited. but anybody, like, you know, when the iPod came out or the iPhone came out, you know, those were big things where like the PC people did an about face and said, okay, we're interested in this. Even though we're PC people, we want this phone or we want this MP3 player. Mm-hmm. You know, and a little bit when AirTags came out, that was like the last big thing. And I can't even remember if that was during Steve Jobs's a lifetime or not. Did it come out after he passed?
After he passed?
Okay. He's been gone a while now. But I can't remember let me rephrase it. His lifetime extended beyond his life because he had things in the pipeline long after he had passed away that were still his thing. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look it up. Because, yeah, Steve Jobs physically passed away, but like his legacy of development lasted for several years afterwards. But yeah, I say the AirTag was the last interesting thing from Apple.
So he died in 2011.
He died in 2011. Okay. So yeah, it's been a significant amount of time. Mm-hmm. Wow. But yeah, so Microsoft is doing more interesting things. They're partnering more with U.S. government for stuff. We've talked about that on the show before. So it's interesting to see where it's going. And Apple is doing a lot, not doing a lot with AI. And they were like Siri was the thing, and now Siri's kind of like wandering helplessly. So I'm going to continue on the Microsoft thing a little bit.
Yeah, keep going.
So Microsoft researchers used AI and supercomputers to narrow down 32 million potential inorganic compounds to 18 promising candidates in less than a week for a new replacement or a new augmentation for lithium. Okay. Now, it would have taken the screening process, would have taken 2 decades to carry out using traditional lab research. Now, that's not saying that they're not verifying their results. That's not saying that we're strictly going with whatever the computer tells us to do. You know, we respect our machine overlords, blah, blah, blah. Someone will know that joke. But, you know, Microsoft is putting money into this to, you know, to make big changes. You know, we're using it to streamline. We're not using it to replace. We are replacing people, but because we're streamlining things. Mm-hmm. So I find that fascinating. So what else you got?
All right. Well, I guess we can kind of flip over to Sony a little bit.
All right. Let's talk about the other big candidate in the room sometimes.
Sony.
Yeah.
Came onto the CES stage.
Uh-huh.
Driving a car with a PS5 controller.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've driven subs with Logitech controllers, so.
That's true. but with this, it was a partnership between Sony and Honda.
Okay.
They are working on their own versions of new EVs.
Okay.
And driverless vehicles.
All right.
This one, though, is going to be built in with a PS5 similar to the Teslas that have essentially gaming PCs in them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But their infotainment system will be run by a PS5, essentially. That's why the PS5 controller connectivity exists.
Uh-huh. So, you know, I mean, I think we all saw back in the day with Fast and the Furious when, you know, you were looking at all the tuner cars and the one dude had, like, it was a PS1 or a PS2, I can't remember PS2. Which. It was a PS2, had, like, the PS2 built in, and, like, everybody in the movie theater went, oh, you know? And I think we're almost taking for granted that gaming PCs are being built into because they're good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And so they're better at controlling some of the stuff for the car. Mm-hmm. You know, not necessarily the driving part. I'm not sure where that is. But, you know, because I've driven in some of these driving games and the AI simulates don't drive as well as I do. But, you know, for the infotainment part of it, I'm fascinated. Mm-hmm. That's very cool.
Yeah. So, but it was just funny to watch a Sony exec get out of the car with a PS5 controller and show it and then started turning the wheels with one of the joysticks.
Yeah.
So everyone was kind of intrigued by the fact that now maybe steering wheels will disappear and it will be controllers that control cars now. Which is another terrifying thing.
Being a child of the 80s, where we had what looked like game controller steering wheels in like, you know, Trans Ams and the DeLorean steering wheel and a couple other cars. And even in the 60s, they had some what I consider almost like joystick control type, you know, steering wheels. That'll be interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing is, I'm sorry, I can't come into work today. I forgot to charge my controller and I can't drive my car. I'm assuming they're going to have like some kind of manual control. What movie was it? Maybe it was either Fifth Element or Judge Dredd or something like that, where they're driving the car and they hit manual override and it pops a steering wheel out for you to actually drive the car.
Oh, yeah.
I'm hearkening back to my 80s and 90s sci-fi. And yes, 80s and 90s cars. If anybody out there is listening who is a child of the 70s and 80s, remember those steering wheels, like, you know, Kit from Knight Rider, that steering wheel. I'm not sure I could physically drive a car with Kit's steering wheel. I thought about it a couple of times when I've seen them. I've never been able to get in one, but I've seen them at like comic book conventions shows and stuff. And I'm like, I'm not sure I could do the turn, you know, because I kind of drive, you know, with. Well, you it's kind of like the, you know, the Tesla this, yeah.
yoke steering
wheel. Yeah, the Tesla yoke is really hard to drive.
It's literally.
So I did sit in one of those, and I found that I drove like I had, like I drive my tractor, like I have a ball on it. I literally was turning the wheel like that. Yeah. I wasn't gripping it, which is probably not safe, but I was not physically driving. I was in it wasn't a simulator, but it was a car that you could move the steering wheel, but it wasn't going to hurt anything. So it wasn't physically going forward, but you could kind of interact with the car. So I'm going to keep on AI a little bit.
All right, keep going. I gotta
so we've all been to a warehouse club or certain stores where they check your receipt before you leave. You know, and for some people that's incredibly annoying. And sometimes it also backs up. I mean, I've been to Sam's Club before where, you know, we're like six cars deep and the person's checking and it's not their fault. It's just everyone decided to leave at the same time, you know, or it's just busy. So Sam's Club is going to be getting rid of, in a lot of places, their receipts checkers, but they're not going to stop checking your receipts. What you're going to do is you're going to go through a set of gates. So think Easy Pass for the Turnpike. You're going to go through a set of gates and it's going to use AI and cameras to scan your cart and do the receipt check and look for things that should have been purchased and or were not purchased correctly or whatever. That is what they're going to do. So you're going to now pass through the gates. So it's very similar. I drive the Turnpike a lot. So it's very similar to Easy Pass. You know, you're going to take your cart. You're going to slow down. You're going to go through the gates. It's going to scan you. You're going to ding, and you're going to keep going, you know. But in all honesty, being a person who, like the Sam's Club I tend to go to, I swear I pick the best time to go when there's like a billion people all checking out at the exact same time, and I'm standing there in line like, oh, it's like 10 people deep, and there's two people on either side, yep. And again, I am not just, you know, besmirching the two people checking. They are moving. They're checking the receipts, but, you know,
there's only so fast that they
can go. You're humans. Yeah. So I find that interesting. I am somewhat intrigued by, you know, because we talked about almost a year ago, Google's AI store that literally you picked up something. Amazon. You picked up something, threw it in your cart, and it knew you checked it out. And by the time you went to go leave, it said, this is all what you had in your cart. You know, and if you put something back, it detected it the other direction. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, and, you know, I'll be honest with you. I like some of the aspect of the cart checking, because at least one time when someone was checking the thing, they looked and they saw that I had two things on my receipt I shouldn't have had. You know, that something got scanned twice. And they're like, well, where's the other one of these? I'm like, I didn't get another one of them. They're like, oh, well, let's fix your receipt. So it has, in my case, saved me money, you know, because somehow they managed to scan something twice and I missed it. So, you know.
Interesting.
Yep.
So kind of sticking with your AI thing. How about real-time data when you're driving a car?
So like when you're watching, you know, any of the F1s or like NASCAR stuff, yeah. They're getting telemetry from the people driving. So, yeah.
Lamborghini at CES
showed
off a way to track both your heart rate, your respiratory rate, and everything else about your Lamborghini as you're trying to drive it. It's giving you every single statistic that they could think of that you would need to know right here.
So they're targeting people who might not be in the best health of driving very fast.
Yes, in a way, horrible sort of way. But essentially, what it's trying to do is it's trying to get you to, I mean, obviously realize what you were trying to do with driving all the statistics of the car. Yeah. But it's also trying to keep you calm and everything else. In a way, but it's also to help improve track time and everything.
I could see it now. His all of his body stats were great until it was time to try to park the Lamborghini, and he darn near had a heart attack.
Yep.
And if you don't know, I don't know if I haven't been in one in a while. I've been in one before, but I haven't been in one in a while. For a while there, the correct way to back up a Lamborghini was to open up the door and sit on the ledge because you could not see through the rear view to back it up correctly. So the official way was to kind of position yourself with the door open, sitting on the ledge, driving with one hand, backing the thing up. That was the way, the only way to back up like the Countach and some of those things. You know, but having ridden one and other types of performance cars, yeah, every time they shift, you know, his heart skips a beat, literally. I find that interesting. I could also see, you know, telemetry from your car saying, hey, you know, you're really stressed. You know, this traffic must be really bothering you. Let's adjust some of the things because you've been making poor decisions. And so you're very stressed. Let's up the sensitivity of the lane change. Let's up the sensitivity of the braking so that, you know, because you were stressed, you may not be braking as effectively. I can see that. I can see that.
It also mentions that it pulls heart rate, body temperature, oxygen level, stress, and fatigue.
He's hyperventilating.
He was going to, like, give you directions to the nearest urgent care. It looks like you have a temperature of 102. Would you like to stop at urgent care?
Yeah. Well,
out?
Your temperature's up.
That's what I'm hearing.
Your body is telling you that you're having problems, you know.
Considering motorsport and in my understanding, if you're driving in a car that is boxed in and it's only nothing but sheet metal,
yeah,
that thing can get up to about almost 200 degrees depending on where you're at.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Especially in stock car.
Oh yeah.
That it can get hot in there. So it this way is just making sure that you are good enough to keep driving.
Yeah. Because, I can remember being in the pits at a NASCAR race.
Yeah.
I had pit pass stuff and I was astounded. And it wasn't even that warm. It was a September race. I can remember it being astounded at the amount of ice that they were literally like shoving into the cars with the drivers to keep them cool. And yeah. I mean, again, this is a September race. It wasn't that warm outside. I wouldn't say, you know, it was September weather, you know, in Chicago, because it was Chicagoland, you know, and yeah, being astounded by the amount of ice that they were shoving into these guys because it was that hot. Because again, it's engine, sheet metal, and you know,
and friction is, and downforce will distribute that heat real easily.
Exactly.
Make the heat really easily.
Yeah, it was amazing. So
this essentially what this is doing is making sure that if you're doing a track day,
yeah,
you're staying healthy during the track day.
Yeah, and have you ever done a track day, Charlie?
I have not.
I've done a track day.
Seen a couple.
Yeah, I've done a track day with my buddy, and he had basically a souped up Charger that had a track pack on it. It was a Hellcat.
Yeah.
And so I got to be the number two with him because officially they could not drive single. They had to drive two because they wanted balance. It was it was a weird thing. They explained it to us, but they wanted balance. They had to have a second person. And so I got to be the second person wearing the helmet and the Nomex and all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, I knew where my heart was a couple of times when we went, we started banking, and I'm like, this is just crazy. Cause yeah. It was a track day. So, you know, he was flat out and it was above 80 miles an hour. Let's just say it that way.
Passing other slower vehicles and then faster vehicles passing.
This track day, you could not have another car on with you.
Oh, okay. So it was only a single car. Okay. Cause most single cars I see are the ones that have cars out everywhere.
He was not able to get into that one. You had to qualify for it.
Oh, okay.
To qualify for that. Okay. Yeah. So this track day was single car runs. Well, it was others, but we were in the single car runs, and you had to have the second person because of the single car run and stuff. And yeah, it was cool. It was cool.
Okay.
Yeah. I would totally do it again. I'm not sure I would be the driver.
Yeah.
I like to drive and I like to drive fast, but I still, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Let's see. We've talked about this before, solid state batteries. Okay. But now I have a company to go with one now, finally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called QuantumScape. And it's a startup, so we'll see how long it lasts before it gets consumed by someone else or gets bigger or whatever. But QuantumScape is, they're starting to actually bring to market solid-state batteries, which is where we're at right now, is we don't have anybody really bringing it still in the test phase, so this is the next step. So solid-state battery is a little bit different than your lithium batteries. It's a little closer to how solid-state drive works, actually. But they're looking at, and here's the numbers they put out, 300 times the density of a traditional lithium battery, 15 minute ultra charge to 80%. So 15 minutes, your battery's full on your vehicle. So I found that interesting. Now I'm going to tie another thing into this because Hertz, and Charlie and I both saw this story, Hertz is dumping their EVs, including Teslas, for gas cars. And I don't know how far you read into the article. I found it interesting that one of the major things in the article I was reading was citing the fact that the repair costs were so expensive. Now, I know that predominantly they were using Teslas. I don't think they were using a lot of other EVs.
From what I'm reading, they use Chevy Bolts.
Okay.
BMW i3s.
Okay. I haven't seen any of those anywhere.
Polestar 2s and Mustang Mach-Es.
Okay, Mach-Es.
But they haven't... But the Teslas... Bolts and i3s have been on the car sales side of
Hertz. Yeah.
But they haven't, like, so far, no Mach-Es or Polestars have shown up yet, but they're saying that they could
in a couple months. So, so what the article I was reading was the repair costs specifically for the Teslas were making it very difficult for them to maintain their fleet. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't see anything mentioned about the Chevy Volt or whatever. Or the Mustangs. So it's possible that they may be dumping regardless because of the current cost. And again, battery would change the cost drastically.
But the thing that Hertz was saying about this story too,
in your story, is
mainly like, the reason why is they're not getting the market for people that want to use their rentable EVs either. Because most of the people that are renting the vehicles are going out from where they're going from. Out super far. So if you get an EV.
Yeah, almost every time I've ever rented a vehicle, it's been for long distance. I rented a vehicle to drive to Chicago because it was cheaper to rent the vehicle than it was to pay the mileage for the company I was working for. And then a couple times on vacation, instead of a bunch of, because you know, for a while there, a lot of my friends would we'd all go together on vacation and rent a place in South Carolina and North Carolina too. And instead of all of us driving, we would rent one of those big vans, you know, like you see that haul people around, like for school buses and such. So we rented one of those from, I think, Hertz or Avis actually. And you know, that was cheaper for us to all pile in to the van with our luggage. As unencumbered adults, none of us had kids at the time, and go down on vacation than it was for each one of us to drive our own vehicles, plus the mileage on our vehicles from here to the Carolinas. So yeah, I've honestly never rented a vehicle other than for repairs that I've ever used like local. I've never gone to like flown into New York and rented a car. Mm-hmm. I've never done that. You know, I've never flown into a city and rented a vehicle ever in my entire life. Never had a reason to.
But Hertz is just killing off their, their EV side of everything.
Now, I'm not surprised. Yeah, I'm not surprised, actually.
Because of the performance of the batteries and how much it costs to replace a battery, I can see where Hertz is coming from with the, you know, but they're turning around and selling some of these for like less than 20K.
Yeah, pennies on the dollar.
Like all the Model 3s that they have go for just about 20,000. Chevy Bullets are 21 and i3s are 17.
Man.
They're still expensive, don't get me wrong, but still a lot cheaper than going out to the dealership and buying a new one.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I don't honestly know a whole lot about BMW's EV market. You know, as many times as we've talked about EVs here, we tend to talk about Asian vehicles like Honda and
you're going German with BMW.
Yeah, we don't talk about the European and Germans
off of
European and
Volkswagens.
Yeah.
Well, because they're under the
conglomerate.
Yeah, but essentially, they're running off the Volkswagen platform for EV, is what I understand. But BMW has their quote unquote own.
Yeah, well, BMW is always BMW. Same thing with Mercedes. Mercedes has always been Mercedes.
Because there's the i3 and the i8.
Yeah.
i8 was their hybrid car.
We have to ask a friend of mine who lives over in the UK what their view of that is. Northern Ireland and UK.
Have a better infrastructure for.
Well, they have better charging and stuff like that, but and it's required over there for some of their stuff. They don't get a choice. But I was just curious, like how dominant BMW is versus some of the other makers. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we don't talk about BMW very much when it comes to EVs.
Not really.
Usually, you know, mostly it's Asian manufacturers like Honda and Yamaha and all of those folks.
Yeah, Toyota. Well, Toyota is actually pushing more hydrogen.
Yes.
Actually, a lot more.
I'm down with that.
Actually, a lot more. You can make a lot of hydrogen. Companies over in Japan are talking more about hydrogen instead of electric. So we'll see how that goes.
In some cases, they don't have the infrastructure because they can't put in charging stations because there's no place to put them.
It's the same here. It's the same about everywhere too.
Well, here we have places to put them. We just have the distance there, you know, and in some of those, you know, there's no place to put, you know, like a friend of mine was over in Japan and was struggling to find a gas station because they had rented a vehicle and they were not going to take the train. They were going to drive to a couple places and they were struggling to find a gas station because it's business or housing. Gas station is not one of those things. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of convenience stores, but no gas station convenience stores, not like a convenient food mart like down the road from us.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Definitely, interesting. Definitely interesting to see how vehicles are going to go, especially with Hertz pulling out of EV for now.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
They had a huge marketing campaign for that.
Well, they were pushing for 25% of their fleet to be electric by 2026 or 2030.
I wonder how that's going to go.
That's not going to go.
No, I wonder how that's going to go.
Yeah, so that's interesting enough. Let's see. I guess we could talk about a recall.
Oh, we love recalls around here, don't we? Yeah.
So a dangerous USB charger from IKEA.
IKEA?
Yes.
I'm interested
it's
now.
It's called the Askstrom 40-watt USB.
None of us are going to be able to.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to pronounce it.
Wait, is the IKEA
All I
stuff.
See is Askstrom. Okay. There's a little dot above the A.
I don't know
if that's pronouncing it correctly.
I'm
not
sure what the diacritic on top of the A means.
IKEA has just urged all customers not to use it anymore, and feel free to bring it back to an IKEA store to get a full refund for the item.
Well, in the grand scheme of things,
actually, no receipt required for the return either. So if you bought it secondhand,
so it's the very much the IKEA way of doing things. We screwed up, we'll fix it. No words.
Yeah.
Which I do like about IKEA because I've taken things back to IKEA and they're like, "Yep, that's wrong. We'll fix it."
Yeah. But yet, so. Now, the recall was posted in Canada, Spain, and the UK, but not here in the US just yet.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that it's slowly coming down the pipeline at some point, but please do not use this charger anymore.
Yeah, so if you bought an IKEA charger that we can't pronounce, you know, it's a plug-in charger for your phones and whatnot.
It's a three-port
charger. Stop using it.
Yeah,
please.
Don't use it anymore, please. We don't want houses burning down.
Yes, we do not. Right, we do not. We do not.
Even though it's cold, you don't need a house burning down.
No, it's not. Yourself. Not the way to warm up. Not the way to warm up. Yeah.
No.
So, So again, we're getting pretty close to wrapping up our time. So, you know, thank you for joining us on Talking Tech, and we're every month we're going to be here live and streaming, and then you can always watch us after the fact. And we appreciate you tuning in, and feel free again to throw things in the chat, or the next time we go live, please jump on with us to do things on the chat. So do you have anything to finish us out, Charlie?
Let's see, anything like relative. Well, I guess we could end off on this one.
Yeah, let's do that.
Why not?
Let's do that. Yeah, we love mini consoles here.
We have mini consoles.
Hey, Margaret.
Everyone likes mini consoles, well, for the most part.
So we should explain what a mini console is, though.
Yeah, so a mini console, essentially a tinier version of the classic console you have at home. So
like an Atari, yes, or a Sega Genesis, like, or that, TurboGrafx-16.
So yeah, the latest mini console.
Uh-huh, I'm looking at it.
The Atari 400.
I love it.
So there are sending out an Atari 400, and it releases in March.
So the Atari 400 was their foray into PCs, which kind of reminded you of the Commodore 64. Or reminded me of the Commodore 64, because I knew my school had them, along with Apple II GSs, which was like the thing. Mm-hmm. But we had a whole bunch of, we had all these Atari computers, mm-hmm, hooked up to TVs, because mm-hmm, there were no monitors. So literally it was hooked up like a game console, yeah, with the 2-3 switch on the back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so it is about half the size of the 79 original.
Yeah.
And it has an updated version.
79 original.
Yep, that's what it says.
I was one.
And also comes with an updated version of the CX40.
The CX40 was a beautiful joystick.
And it also has 5 USB ports that you can connect other joysticks,
hey, Declan,
and other things. And you can also sideload games with this thing as well, is what it says.
Yeah. There were some awesome games that came out on the Atari PC. Well, I don't want to call it a PC engine, because that's an NEC thing, but it was, so you had the Ataris that were in most people's homes that were strictly consoles. This Atari, again, reminds you of a Commodore 64. It had a keyboard, had input-output aside from game consoles and things like that. So, yeah, it's...
I'm just wondering if they're going to make a keyboard on this one actually usable.
I don't know. We're looking at a picture of it.
Never mind. This is actually the image from...
The original?
Not the original. This is the remake.
So it'd be interesting.
Again, with it being about only half the size.
Yeah, that may be too small to...
But assuming that they're allowing you to plug in like extra USB devices instead of...
And I have one of the retro... my in-laws got me one of the retro Commodore 64s, and the keyboard is fully functional. Mm-hmm. You can program on it. Mm-hmm.
If you really wanted to try the type on...
Well, in some cases, you had to write a loader program to get the game to run. I can remember playing Top Gun on the 64, and I had to write a little loader program to load and get it to run. At one point, I had it on cassette tape.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So the company is actually called just Retro Games.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They also come out with a Amiga 500.
Oh my gosh, I love the Amigas.
Commodore 64.
Yep.
And then an updated version of the 2600, which
I wonder if that's the company who made my 64. I'll have to look and see on the box, because I still have the box, because I'm going to be that nerd who keeps the box.
But the updated version of the 2600 had full cartridge support.
And that's someone I was looking at. I think we talked about that actually a couple of talking texts ago. I think we briefly mentioned it. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the Amiga. Mm-hmm. The Amiga was a really cool platform, and they're still actually developing an OS for it. So you can get an Amiga OS to put onto current hardware that functions like an Amiga. But what made the Amiga different was, even into the late 90s, because the Amiga was developed, 60s, 70s, 80s. Even into the late 90s, people were doing the graphics for TV shows with the Amiga.
Nice.
Okay. And I may not have my memory correct on this, because I don't have the data in front of me. But I think at some point, Video Toaster, which is what they used to do Babylon 5, the TV show, was run off of Amiga stuff, or had roots in Amiga. I can't remember. I'll have to Google it, so I could be totally wrong. Oh, Margaret remembers the 64, yes. Or the TRS-80, as we affectionately called it, the Trash 80. But love those platforms. I still have them, actually. The Amigas had a huge, huge still in video, because no one could touch them. Even Apple. When it came to,
at the time,
Amiga was good at creating video, so CGI. They were them and Silicon Graphics, SGI Incorporated. So their Indigos and their IREX based stuff, those were like dominating marketing for a while. Sun as well, were dominating the market. If you were going to do like, you know, like digital animation, it was there. It wasn't Apple and it wasn't PC. It was those guys. Mm-hmm. And then, frankly, their market shares fell away and stuff like that. And in going back to Steve Jobs, he came up with the Next Station, which was a rip on, and it's still a good platform, but it was a rip on, without question, it was a rip on a Sun Spark Station. but that thing like had features and stuff that even today I'm like, oh my gosh, that thing was a billion years ahead.
Oh yeah.
Sitting down at the Next Station, you're like, wow, this thing had all of these features that now we appreciate.
Oh yeah.
Then not so much. And like, I have a friend from high school. I won't call him out, but he'll know who he is if he's ever watching this, was like the biggest Amiga guy ever. And like, it was funny. We would do stuff on our PCs and go, yeah, I could do that on an Amiga like 10 years ago. He was that guy, but not in a like an annoying way.
Kind of like the Android guy to the Apple guy.
Yeah.
Oh, we had that feature like 6 years ago. I don't know what you're talking about. Why it's so funny now.
Yeah. I mean, he did in a polite way, but he would talk about it and we're like, oh my gosh, really? Yeah. Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah. So if you're interested in this Atari 400, it is going to be 120 and pre-orders are open now.
$120?
Yeah, $120.
That's not bad.
And it releases on March 28th.
That's not bad because some of the retro consoles are two something now, to three something.
Well,
and if you want some of the original ones that they're not making, they're like five, six now.
Well, like Atari came out with, well, the one from Atari, the 2600 was like 130, 140 because
that's
of the
bad
cartridge connectivity. Yeah,
that's not bad.
But they also came out with a Pro Station, which essentially was the 2600, but without the cartridge slot.
Uh-huh.
That was only $100.
Yeah.
And that was like 200.
That's a good price. That's a good price point. Like $100 is expensive, but not expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're looking at retro gaming. So, because I just looked at a Sega at a store, an original Sega Genesis CD, and they wanted like $560 for it. Yeah.
Yeah, because the Saturn with the CD? Well, not the Saturn. The Genesis.
It was the Genesis, CD, the CD
with
thing.
The CD expansion on it.
It was very expensive.
Because the CD expansion didn't sell very well.
Nope.
People are not finding the CD as much anymore. So
that
everyone is trying to find
those CD are the white whales, kind of, for a lot of people. So the Sega CD or the TurboGrafx CD. Mm-hmm. Those are the two ones like people are desperately looking for.
Or the CDI from Philips.
Oh, I love the CDI. Yeah.
A lot of the CD-based consoles at that point in time, besides the PlayStation.
Yeah, the PlayStation
were very hard to come by. Mm-hmm. And still are hard to come by now.
Yeah.
Because they didn't sell very well because the CD end of it was super expensive.
Like the Sega Saturn. Sega Saturn had a beautiful, beautiful console, but had almost no games at launch, and that's what killed it.
Yep.
That's what killed it. So so we ended with games, as we almost always do at some point when we talk about games. So thank you again for joining us. Again, feel free to drop something in the comments. This turns into a podcast later, so you can listen to it and hear us jabber about all kinds of things. So have a wonderful day and stay safe out there, and see you on the internet.